Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Weary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
What to do with two suspended Liberal MPs if the New Democrats alleging personal misconduct against them don't make formal complaints? The fate of two grits has been left in limbo. Liberal Whip Judy Foote joins us to discuss her party's plan to deal with the harassment claims.
Canadian veterans are reportedly heading to Iraq to join Kurdish fighters in their ground combat against the Islamic State terrorist group. They apparently feel the Canadian military response just isn't good enough. McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru, who has covered the conflict from the front lines, weighs in on the mission.
Well, it's like the Oscars for the House of Commons. McLean's hands out its Parliamentarian of the Year awards. We'll let you know who is the best orator, the hardest working MP, the most knowledgeable, and, of course, the Parliamentarian of the Year.
We also look at a new book that gives a new perspective on U.S. President John F. Kennedy. And the McLean's panel weighs in on the finance minister's lack of analysis for a $500 million program and the stern sentence handed down in the robocall scandal.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. The harassment allegations that have rocked Parliament Hill seem to be stuck in a bit of a stalemate. 2 weeks ago, we learned that Liberal MPs Scott Andrews and Massimo Pacetti have been suspended from the Liberal caucus over allegations of personal misconduct. The accusations were made by two women NDP MPs. Now, they haven't filed formal complaints yet, and the two Liberals deny the claims.
This week, the Board of Internal Economy brought forward temporary rules to deal with misconduct between MPs, and it has tasked a House committee to begin work on permanent policies. That process is more of a general way to deal with a problem, but the Speaker has offered a way to come to a resolution on the specific allegations at hand. It would bring in a third party to investigate and keep the case confidential. But with the New Democrats in this case hesitant to come forward, Liberal leader Justin Trudeau says at this time he can't decide what to do with his MPs.
I'm going to wait and see if there is indeed over the next couple of days a response from the other parties because I think the proposition from the Speaker is reasonable. And if indeed it doesn't come to fruition, then we will look at next steps.
So what are the other options? How do the Liberals move forward? And will the suspended MPs get a formal process to air their side of the story? To try and answer some of these questions, I'm joined on the phone now by Liberal Whip Judy Foote. Ms. Foote, thank you very much for joining us on the show. I guess the first question is, what's the situation at this moment for your party and the decision to do of what to do with those two suspended Liberal MPs?
Well, let me say first how pleased I was that the Speaker responded positively to our request to put in place a separate process to deal with the present situation. We knew that this one had to be dealt with as expeditiously as possible, and we know that putting in place a long-term process to deal with future incidents, if any should arise, and hopefully they won't, will take some time. So this one, it was important to have the Speaker look at this seriously and find a way to put in place a process that would be neutral, that would offer confidentiality and would be impartial. And he's done that, and I welcome that. I know that the four MPs involved, you know, have been invited to participate in the process. I know that from the Liberal MPs, they have indicated, or they did initially when they put out the press releases denying the allegations, that they would cooperate in whatever manner they could. I am hopeful that the other MPs involved, the MPs who made the allegations, will come forward as well, and that we can get a resolution to this.
Have you heard back from the NDP yet as to whether those MPs are willing to take part in this? Because so far, all the indications that we've received are that they do not want to file a formal complaint and go through.
Well, the latest I heard was when I did a panel with an NDP MP, actually, who indicated that it would be up to the two MPs concerned whether or not they want to participate. She did not say at that time that they wouldn't. Whether or not they will, reconsider, and whether or not in light of what was said by Nikki Ashton was actually the MP who was on the panel with me and said, you know, it'll be entirely up to the women whether or not they want to come forward. I'm hoping that's a sign. So I'd like to give it some time for them to reflect on how important it would be to take part in the process, having lodged a complaint. But, of course, it is their decision to be made, and they should not be forced to do anything.
So just to be clear, you have not received any response yet as to whether they're willing to take part?
Nothing formal, no. All I have is and I'm not sure that they would get back to me, as it were. The offer, don't forget, has been made by the Speaker. What the Speaker has said, of course, and is that all parties involved here will need to cooperate to resolve an issue like this. So it would be to the Speaker that they would indicate what their next steps are.
Justin Trudeau, after the caucus meeting on Wednesday, said that they were looking at other options, because the big question is, what do you do if these two MPs don't take part in this confidential process that the Speaker has offered? He said they're looking at all their options moving forward, but they're going to wait and see if they get a response. What are those other options that Justin Trudeau was referring to that you could possibly take part in if you don't get a response from the two NDP MPs?
I think it's safe to say that the leader and the team around him are exploring what options are available. We remain hopeful that the process that the Speaker has offered will in fact be the preferred option of the four MPs involved. But that's not to rule out, obviously we have to look at other options, and that's a responsible position for him to take, and he's doing that. I don't know what those options are. I have not had that discussion with him. I've been dealing with the present situation in terms of, my request to the Speaker and the Speaker responding positively, and waiting to hear whether or not the MPs involved, particularly the two who made the allegations, will participate in the process that's been offered that is confidential and is impartial.
The National Post is reporting that the Liberals are looking at the possibility of getting a judge or somebody to conduct an internal disciplinary investigation to try and figure out what exactly happened. Is that an option that would be considered by the party?
You know, what options are being explored is something that the leader would be looking at. We still remain hopeful that the two MPs who've made the allegations will come forward. But in the possibility that they don't, you do have to be prepared. And we're hopeful that, the MPs involved will have an opportunity to be heard by a neutral third party. But in the interim, you do have to look at the possibility that they may not, and explore other options. And what those options are, I leave that with the leader.
How are relations between the two parties right now? Because it seems like MPs from your party, as well as MPs from the New Democrats, are arguing on both sides that the other party is playing politics with this issue. And it seems like things are getting rather testy and agitated between the Liberals and the New Democrats right now.
Well, we sit in the same side of the House of Commons. Our lobbies are next to each other. I certainly haven't sensed any animosity as such. We continue to work together. I think there are different views, among the MPs in both parties on how this should be handled. But everybody's entitled to their opinion. Having said that, there are four MPs involved here, directly involved, who need a resolution to this particular situation. It's not an easy one for anyone to deal with, and we're doing our best.
As myself and many other reporters have noticed, we are getting it from both sides. We're hearing some anger from the NDP over how this was made public. We hear the Liberals saying we had to act, we had to do the right thing, but it seems like it's getting nasty. But you're saying you don't see that at all in the process?
No, and let me just go back to that, because this is an important point to make here. What we made public was the fact that we had to suspend, that the leader had no choice but to suspend two of our MPs for allegations of personal misconduct. We did not identify the party. We did not identify the MPs who are making the allegations, and we did not even identify the gender. So we went at this in a very responsible way, ensuring that anything that could have identified them remained confidential. So it's not... For them to say, that we made this public, the minute that an MP of another party approached the leader of a different party to lodge a complaint, that's making it public. And when they say that no formal complaint was lodged, I'm not sure what constitutes a formal complaint in their mind, because when you speak to the leader of another party, you go public and you lodge a complaint, and he had no choice but to deal with it.
Your leader, Justin Trudeau, said that he would wait just a few days to see whether there was any response. When is that cutoff point before you start to look at those other options that the leader's office is considering right now?
Well, I think it's, you know, the leader is hopeful that the process that the speaker has put in place will work in this for this particular circumstance. I don't want to be, I mean, he said a couple of days, you know, and you put a benchmark out there, but that doesn't mean that, you know, it has to happen within that time frame. This is an important issue. Everyone involved here needs to have the opportunity to reflect, to look at what it means, to consider the process that the speaker is offering, to look at the fact that it will be a confidential process, that it will be impartial. You know, this may take a little bit of time, but in the interim, while all of that is happening, in the event that the decision is that, you know, the MPs who are making the allegations don't want to participate, there has to be another option that the leader can consider, and that's a responsible avenue for him to take. And the time frame, I don't know, but we're certainly not rushing the MPs who've made the allegations, but at the same time, we have to bear in mind that there are two Liberal MPs who are denying the allegations.
So you can't say whether it's days or weeks, I imagine sometime soon?
Again, that will be up to the leader, and he will take into consideration what is happening with respect to the process that's being offered by the speaker, and what other issues that he has to consider in terms of going forward.
That was Liberal Whip Judy Foote discussing how to move forward on allegations of misconduct against two Liberal MPs. You're listening to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Canadian military veterans are apparently heading to Iraq to take part in the fight against ISIS, but they're not going as a part of the official mission. They're doing this on their own. The CBC reports it has spoken with several veterans who have already, or are planning to, travel to the conflict zone to take part in the battle against the Islamic State terrorist group.
They would be fighting alongside Kurdish troops, and some say they are joining the ground combat because they feel Canada's military efforts just aren't good enough. The news comes just days after the Canadian Armed Forces held a briefing to update the public on the mission. But there were more questions than answers. In an exchange with the Globe and Mail's Stephen Chase, Captain Paul Forget wouldn't discuss how many civilians have been killed or injured as a result of Canadian airstrikes.
Can you say with confidence that you haven't incurred civilian casualties so far, or is that just you're not paying attention to that? And
it's not that we're not paying attention to it. What I said is that as part of the targeting process, everything that we do is done with an eye to minimalize collateral damage and any damage to civilian infrastructure.
Do you have a certainty that you're not incurring civilian casualties then with these strikes?
I can never say anything like that with absolute certainty.
Well, to speak about the mission and then about the veterans joining Kurdish fighters, I'm joined now by Maclean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru, who has traveled to the front lines of this conflict as a part of his coverage for the magazine. So, Michael, on Tuesday, the Canadian military announced that it had bombed a bunker near Kirkuk, and you were actually on that front when you were covering the story for Maclean's magazine. Can you describe it for us?
Sure. Kirkuk is a major city north of Baghdad. It's multi-ethnic. It's been contested by the Kurds and by the government in Baghdad ever since the Saddam Hussein was overthrown. And the Kurdish Peshmerga took Kirkuk when ISIS began their rampage earlier on this year. Just west of the city, however, is where the front line stretches. And it's quite flat desert territory, and that expanse stretches all the way into Syria, where, of course, ISIS has its stronghold. When I was there, the front line in several places was quite defined. ISIS has taken over villages and towns, but there were also exposed bunkers and strong points facing off against Peshmerga positions.
So how effective do the Kurds say the airstrikes have really been in that area?
They've been very happy. They say that they have the airstrikes. They credit the airstrikes with stopping Islamic State's advance against Kirkuk and against other parts of Kurdistan as well. I mean, they're always quick to add that they lack the ground forces to exploit this advantage. They say that they don't have the sort of heavy equipment, armored personnel, carriers, tanks, that sort of thing, to really take full advantage of the airstrikes and actually retake territory. So they say that it has stopped, it has blunted Islamic State's advance, but they say they don't have the forces on the ground that they would really like to have in order to reverse that advance and push Islamic State farther to the west and farther away from their territory.
Is that why the military has said can't say that it's actually forced ISIS to lose ground?
Well, I mean, I suspect they're being cautious, and there are. I mean, I should be clear. There certainly are positions that the Kurds and Iraqi government forces have retaken. I visited a recently retaken town myself. But I mean, the front lines are not moving wildly, dozens of kilometers a day. I mean, they've fluctuated somewhat, and again, the Islamic State's advance has stopped, but they have not been rolled back across large expanses of territory very quickly yet.
So we've flown over 60 sorties with our fighter jets, and we've only had 4 airstrikes. So in only 4 instances, they've dropped bombs. Why is it so few out of so many sorties?
It's a puzzling question, and I have to be somewhat speculative here, because the short answer is we don't know. And we should also note that Canada is operating as part of a coalition, so its decisions are not made, willy-nilly, completely independent of our allies. That said, again, 4 actual kinetic strikes out of more than 60 sorties does seem a little bit puzzling at first glance, at least. There are a few possibilities. I mean, I think one might simply be, notwithstanding the sort of open strongholds that I described that I saw last month, Islamic State is also in villages, and it may be that Canada is avoiding the sort of airstrikes that might result in heavy civilian casualties. We know that Australia has called off strikes for those reasons. It may also be that Canada and other coalition partners want their airstrikes to be most effective. In other words, they want to drop bombs when the Kurds on the ground or the Iraqi government forces on the ground are best placed to take advantage of that. It's also possible, I'm struck by an instance when I was there last month, that Kurds at a certain stronghold, they described Islamic State was about a few kilometers away across open ground. And the situation that they described is that Islamic State would periodically kind of sally out of their own villages and attack Kurdish lines, and very quickly coalition airstrikes could be called in to hit those Islamic State positions when the Islamic State fighters expose themselves. And it strikes me that that would only really be possible if fighter jets were continuously in the air. So again, perhaps there's a certain amount of waiting and being ready until targets present themselves.
Does it surprise you that the military has stopped saying for sure that there was no collateral damage when questioned about possible civilian casualties?
I suspect, and again, I'm being speculative here, but I suspect they're simply being cautious. They don't want to be in a position where they claim that there's no civilian casualties, and then it emerges that there, in fact, were.
And let's just talk about the CBC report now with Canadian veterans who are apparently planning or already over in Iraq, preparing to fight against ISIS. It seems like a very unique situation in the fact that we have Canadians fighting with ISIS that we have heard about, and we now hear of Canadians who are going to fight with Peshmerga fighters against ISIS. Is this common? Is this a surprise to you, or does this happen in a lot of conflict zones?
It's not a big surprise to me. I mean, I know for a fact, and met one of them, that there are Canadian Kurds that are currently involved in the fight against ISIS. The gentleman I met is a retired commander, but he was still giving advice, and I heard of other Canadian Kurds that were actively taking part in the fight against ISIS. What CBC is reporting is a little bit different, and these are apparently, if I understand the report correctly, non-Kurdish Canadian combat veterans. That's news to me in this conflict, but it's not unprecedented, and it's not all that surprising. There are American combat veterans fighting with the Kurds in Syria. There is reportedly one Canadian Israeli woman that is involved in the fight as well, either in Syria or Iraq. And frankly, in other foreign conflicts, this has happened as well. Canadians actively took part in the Vietnam War. They were involved in the conflicts in the former Yugoslavia, going all the way back to the Spanish Civil War. So it's unusual. It's interesting, but it's certainly not unprecedented.
What are the legal issues if we have our veterans going over there and trying to fight with these different entities? Are there legal problems that they could face by doing this?
Potentially, yes, and it gets very murky. We do have a Foreign Enlistment Act, which applies to Canadians in foreign conflict and has been going back for decades. I tried to get answers from the Canadian government specifically pertaining to Kurds, Canadians that were fighting with Kurds in Iraq, and didn't get a straight answer about a month ago. The biggest potential problem is if the Canadians are fighting with a group that Canada considers a terrorist group. Now, this is where things get interesting with the Kurds in Syria. The main Kurdish faction fighting in Syria, certainly in Kobani, is the YPG, which is an affiliate of or closely related to the PKK in Turkey. They both look up to Abdullah Öcalan, the Turkish-Kurdish imprisoned leader. They're very closely connected at the very least, and Canada considers the PKK a terrorist group, even though, and so does the United States, even though the United States, of course, is bombing Islamic State in and around Kobani, essentially acting as an ally of the YPG on the ground. So things do get potentially very, very murky from a legal perspective there.
That was McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru discussing the mission in Iraq.
Still to come on the show, the McLean's panel weighs in on the analysis fiasco at the finance department, as well as the sentencing in the robocalls case. We also speak with some of the winners from the Parliamentarian of the Year awards, and we look at a new book on U.S. President John F. Kennedy.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Aaron Wary, the Associate Editor of McLean's, and the McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Cormac.
All right, so the first thing we're going to talk about is the harassment allegations on Parliament Hill. We do have a temporary process in place now for MPs to deal with any harassment between them and other MPs. But the real issue is the specific allegations made by the two NDP MPs. They're not willing to come forward at last check. There has been a new confidential process that has been brought forward by the Speaker that he's willing to offer these MPs to try and come to some sort of resolution on this, but they're not willing to take part. It kind of leaves the two Liberal MPs in limbo. What happens from here on out, John?
Yeah, I wish I knew. I'm sure a lot of people in Hill wish they knew. I don't think there's any clear path from the mess we've gotten ourselves into here to some kind of resolution. Liberals told me this week that they're confident that somehow this will be resolved. They think that there's slow but steady momentum towards some form of resolution. The pieces of the puzzle that you've talked about being put in place. Not that the process they're talking about would apply retroactively to what's already happened, but you know, they start to frame the idea that there should be processes involved in the Hill. People are taking some hope from that there was something, but I'm still afraid. I don't see any real cause for optimism. What you need for some kind of clear resolution is for the victims here to say, we'll take part in a process that's set up, and so far I think every signal out of the NDP camp is that they're not going to do that.
And the Liberals right now are looking at their options outside of these two NDP MPs taking part, and there have been reports that they're looking at maybe a retired judge to come in and listen to the two Liberal MPs and investigate this further. But without the victims taking part, I mean, Aaron, would that only be a partial conclusion to this matter?
Yeah, this becomes, as other people are sort of starting to point out, and I think this is becoming the idea, this becomes an interesting test for Justin Trudeau. It's how do you come up with a solution or design a system or come up with some sort of process that not only gets you to a resolution, but gets you to a resolution that everyone is going to be at least reasonably comfortable with. There seems to be some suggestion that, you know, the Liberals took notes of what these complaints were, so those could be used in some kind of process. I don't know. Do you ever, is it possible here to design a process that we'll get to the end of it and we'll go, well, some kind of justice has been done here, we've had a fair process, and now it's come to a conclusion? I guess the decision point becomes for Trudeau is, you know, at some point you have to decide whether you're going to let these guys back into caucus or you're going to leave them out. And that has to be informed by whatever this process has been. So can he possibly get to a situation where he can be comfortable one way or the other with keeping these guys in or out? And if you leave them, if you bring them in, can Justin Trudeau be comfortable that he's letting them in justly? And if he leaves them out, can it be satisfied that those two guys are left out of caucus fairly? It's a remarkable little predicament.
All right, so we're going to switch gears here to Finance Minister Joe Oliver. He appeared before a committee this week, and under questioning, he admitted that the finance department didn't do its own full analysis on the EI hiring credit that was handed out. It's a $550 million program, and they relied on analysis done by the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, a lobby group, in other words. So, Aaron, you've been writing on this. What are the issues with the government taking a lobby group's analysis and using that to produce policy?
Yeah, this has become a fascinating little episode in how policy gets made. So the government comes out and says, we're going to have this EI hiring credit. It's going to be $550 million. It's going to allow people to, small businesses, to hire more people. The CFIB, the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, comes out and says, this is going to create 25,000 person years of employment. So far, so good. There's been a few quibbles. Mike Moffat and Stephen Gordon on the Maclean's website come out and say, I don't know if this is really going to work. But then the PBO, the Parliamentary Budget Officer, comes out and says, actually, it's going to create about 800 jobs. Suddenly, you have two data points that have nothing to do with each other, seemingly, and the government has to try to explain itself. And at that point, instead of explaining itself and saying, well, here's our analysis, the government defers to the CFIB. So at that point, I ask them, well, where's your own analysis? Do you have any of your own analysis? And they basically said no. So Joe Oliver essentially just had to own up to that this week. And he seemed to kind of crystallize the issue when you had these MPs saying to the minister, well, why didn't you do your own analysis? And him saying, well, CFIB said it was a good idea, so we kind of went with that. First of all, you have to deal with the fact that the CFIB is an organization that represents small businesses. They're not entirely removed objective observer here. The second part of it is, how on earth does the finance department, the finance minister, propose something without having done analysis of how it's going to be done or what's going to happen to it? That seems crazy. And I think it gets back to this entire idea of how much analysis we're getting about policy and how much of a discussion we're getting about how policy is working. We should have something from the government. We should have the PBO. We should have committees looking into this. And now we have it in this perfect little kind of crystallized issue of just kind of a ridiculous situation.
We'll switch gears here for the last topic. Michael Sona, he has been convicted of breaking election laws by trying to prevent people from voting in the robocall scandal from the 2011 election campaign, specifically in Guelph. He has now been sentenced to 9 months in jail, 1 year probation after that. John, is it an appropriate sentence for what he did?
I would guess it probably is, although, you know, it is an area of law where there's not a ton of precedent, right? So that, I don't like to apply my own judgment, as I like to look and see what other cases have done, and I don't think that there are many other cases.
I think this is the first conviction and sentencing of this crime.
It's almost by definition, it sets the standard rather than following a standard for what's appropriate. But more broadly on this thing, I mean, the question we have to ask now is, does this bite as far as the government goes? Does this have any real impact? I'm not sure. You know, you go back to 2012 when the government, the Conservatives, pleaded guilty essentially to what was called the In and Out scandal, a financial skullduggery from the 2006 campaign, I think.
Yep.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
You know, at the time we were very interested in Around the Hill. I doubt you can find one Canadian in 100 who has any idea what it was or cares about what it was to this day. So I'm not sure the Conservatives, despite having had a series of questionable stories arise about the way they run elections, and they run them hard, whether that's really hurt them so far.
All right, thank you very much. Co-host Aaron Wary, Ottawa Bureau Chief for Maclean's, John Geddes, and I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for Rogers Radio and City News.
Who's the best of the best in the House of Commons? Well, we now know thanks to the 8th Annual Parliamentarian of the Year Awards handed out this week by Maclean's Magazine. The awards ceremony took place just steps from Parliament Hill in the historic Chateau Laurier. Altogether, there were 8 awards handed out, with members of all major parties taking home some hardware. The winners were actually chosen by their colleagues in the House of Commons in a weighted survey that was then analyzed by the polling firm Ipsos Reid.
Now this year, the gift of the gab was with Green Party leader Elizabeth May, who received the award for Best Orator. The hardest working MP is, without a doubt, Employment Minister Jason Kenney, who shows up to countless community events across the country as he juggles his responsibilities as a minister.
But I often, on weekends, do Friday, Saturday, Sunday, six or more events a day. I'm going slow these days, and then especially during the sessional weeks in Ottawa, of course, everyone's schedule is completely jammed up.
You're on, I don't know, two cabinet committees?
Operations, a chair, planning and priorities, social affairs, and sometimes there are ad hoc committees as well.
The most knowledgeable in the House is someone who the media knows well, since he can scrum with reporters on almost any topic. This year, the award goes to the NDP's Nathan Cullen.
Meanwhile, the Rising Star Award is given to the MP who is on their way up the political ladder, and this year it's Conservative Michelle Rempel, who was also the Minister of State for Western Economic Diversification. She speaks to us about putting partisanship aside to get the job done.
We can do something here that resembles work. Even though I might not agree with someone on their particular ideology, that doesn't mean that we can't sit down and talk about mutual interests or different viewpoints, because that's the policy process. I mean, if you remove that from the process, I really think you've missed the point here. And certainly there are members of other parties that I have a great working relationship with, but the key is that we're coming into that with mutual respect.
There's also an award for the nicest person on the Hill. For the seventh year, the most collegial MP is the NDP's Peter Stauffer. Stauffer has always had a warm heart and a kind word. Heck, on his parliamentary profile, he wrote that his former occupation is being a country gentleman. He also talks about the need for bipartisanship in the House.
Much easier to get something done if you start working with members of the other parties instead of always becoming you're a new Democrat, so they're Liberals and Conservatives, they're the enemy, you know? Mm-hmm. It's simply not true. And vice versa. I've met many of the other side who treat us like, oh God, we can't hang around them or be seen talking to them because the kids in short pants may report back to the boss. Simply not true. I find through committee and other processes that if you work with them and give them an idea and then work in a positive way, in a proactive way, you can get a lot of things done.
Independent Brent Rathgaber is the MP who best represents his constituents. He made headlines last year when he quit the Conservative caucus. He speaks with Maclean's political editor Paul Wells about his choice to sit on his own in the House.
You were rather famously a member of the Conservative caucus and now sit as an independent. Did that change your relationship with the folks back home at all?
Oh, considerably. When I was a member of the caucus, I acted like a good member of the caucus. I defended the government. I submitted pre-written op-ed pieces to the local newspapers. I, you know, defended the government at meetings in my constituency office and when I was speaking in public. Now, after June of 2013, that all changed, and of course now as an independent, I criticize the government when I think the government deserves to be criticized, and I compliment it when I think it deserves to be complimented, and I'm able to have much more candor with respect to my constituents, more thoughtful, and I would say intelligent debates, because I'm not restricted to talking points.
Now, former PC cabinet minister Flora MacDonald was given the Lifetime Achievement Award. When she was elected to the House of Commons in 1972, she was the only woman in her party, and since leaving politics in 1988, she has traveled the globe promoting women's rights and getting more women involved in politics. She speaks about her work and gives advice to our current MPs.
I worked with women and congratulated women and tried to be involved with them, but I have always thought that one must not distinguish and try to make two groups of people, one male and one female, and that's it. Mm. You know, I just don't like that sort of thing. Well, one of the things that I would say to women and to men as well, learn how to speak properly. I mean, it's people getting up and rambling on without anybody being able to really discern what they're saying. I mean, to me, I would always prepare for asking a question as much as I would prepare for the answers that I would give if I were a minister. Mm. I mean, you have to be able to tell all the people out there on television what it is you're trying to find out, because it will resonate with them or it will not. And unless you can do that, you're not winning the battle in Parliament.
But the big prize of the night went to Liberal Erwin Cotler, who is this year's Parliamentarian of the Year. Cotler has been praised by members from all parties for his international legal and humanitarian work. He tells us what makes an ideal parliamentarian.
He's someone who appreciates that he or she has a multiple set of intersecting roles, beginning with being an ombudsperson for the constituency they represent to be petitioning government for redress of grievance. Second, a kind of representational role, not only with regard to individuals within the constituency, but with regard to causes that are of a cross-cutting nature, maybe healthcare in my constituency, environment, and the like. The third, the parliamentarian is a legislator. He can initiate legislation as a member of the governing party, or even in opposition through a private member's bill. The fourth thing is a parliamentarian is an overseer of the operations of government. We sometimes forget this, but this is where parliamentarians have that responsibility, really, to oversee the public purse. But it goes beyond that in terms of accountability as a whole. Then there's the public engagement role, engaging with civil society. There's a lot that we as parliamentarians can learn from, whether it be NGOs, whether it be students, whether it be scientists, but we can be the beneficiaries of a lot of learning out there who can help us in developing private members' bills or public policy and the like. And then there's the parliamentarian who at the end of the day, and even as he or she is first elected, is a member of a political party. So you work with your caucus, and through your caucus you develop policies, and with those policies you try to work across party lines, and that's when it all comes together, hopefully for the public good.
For complete profiles of all the winners of the Parliamentarian of the Year awards, go to macleans.ca or pick up the latest issue of Maclean's magazine.
Still to come on the show, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with award-winning author Andrew Cohen about his new book on U.S. President John F. Kennedy.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine. November 22nd is a dark day in American history, the anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination in 1963. This month, a new book by Canadian author Andrew Cohen takes us back 5.5 months before JFK's death to what Cohen argues is the most important 48 hours of his presidency.
The book is called 2 Days in June, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes caught up with Andrew Cohen to talk about it. John, what's this book about?
Cormac, Andrew Cohen has written here in fine-grained detail about two speeches Kennedy gave back-to-back in June of 1963. One day he gives a landmark speech on U.S.-Soviet relations at American University, and this, remember, is the height of the Cold War, just a few months after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then on the following day, June 11th, JFK goes on national TV to talk about the plight of black Americans. But when we start with the Russian speech, here's how Cohen sets it up.
Kennedy is going to make an overture. He's going to make an offer to Khrushchev. He's going to speak of the Russians in a way that is almost subversive, that no American president has spoke since Franklin Roosevelt, when the Russians were America's allies 18 years earlier in 1945. This is the Cold War. Mm-hmm. The Russians and the Americans have nearly incinerated themselves.
The height of the Cold War.
The height of the Cold War. Yeah. They've nearly incinerated themselves 8 months earlier. Kennedy's looking for a way in. So that speech is carefully worded. The president will draw thoughts from a number of people, including John Kenneth Galbraith, but he will not go to the usual suspects. He will not consult the congressional leadership. He will not even consult his vice president. And the reason is he's worried that if they get wind of this speech, it'll be leaked and they'll try and sink it. Not his vice president, but the congressional leadership.
So that June 10th speech changes the course of the Cold War.
But the very next day, June 11th, Kennedy's on TV giving a major civil rights speech. So why did he deliver these speeches as sort of a 1-2 punch?
He didn't really plan it that way. Events in Alabama were forcing his hand. Let's listen to how Andrew Cohen explains that.
John F. Kennedy is handling a crisis in Alabama, in which the governor of Alabama, George Wallace, is refusing to integrate the big state institution, which is the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. JFK knows this is going to be a crisis and it's an opportunity for him, but he won't go on the air until it's resolved. It will not be resolved till 3:30 in the afternoon of June the 11th, which is a Tuesday, which in Washington is 5:30, whereupon JFK will turn to Ted Sorensen and say, Ted, it's time to give that speech on civil rights tonight. Ted Sorensen says, what speech?
Yes.
There is no speech. JFK says, well, there better be, because the networks are booked for 8 p.m., all three of them, as they were then known, and we have to go on the air. That was a job for Ted Sorensen. So there is this madcap, feverish activity in what was usually the throbbing White House literary factory, in which Ted Sorensen is putting together this speech. Bobby Kennedy has arrived with one of his deputies from the Justice Department. JFK continues an afternoon of appointments with a number of people, from Edward R. Murrow to the head of his space program. Bobby Kennedy says, don't worry, Mr. President, you can go on the air and speak extemporaneously, which in the end, JFK will do.
So, John, he basically spoke off the cuff.
Well, not quite. He did have a Ted Sorensen speech, but he used some improvisation. These were both really great speeches, but very different ones. Cohen works at finding a common thread between them, though. In the first, he says Kennedy was humanizing the Russians, and then around in the second, he was doing the same thing, sort of humanizing black Americans.
So are these speeches remembered for the oratory or more of the impact?
A bit of both. Cohen thinks that Kennedy's most consequential moments are both in this, you know, this brief 48-hour period. Might as well listen to him. Here he is summing up the case.
It's, in a sense, Kennedy's high summer. Mm. This is the peak of his presidency. I call it his crowded hour, Kennedy's crowded hour, in which all that he's done, all that he's tried to do, all that he's wanted to do, have led in 2 days, will lead, although in this interrupted, abbreviated presidency, his two greatest achievements. His greatest achievement will be the limited nuclear test ban treaty, which will be approved in Moscow, signed and approved by Congress by October of 63. He will live to see that. That's his greatest achievement in foreign affairs. His greatest achievement in domestic affairs is indeed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which he will not carry through. Johnson will. So you see here a president in what was a whiplash, feverish stewardship or administration, reaching a point at which he says to himself, if I'm going to do it, now's the time to do it.
It's a fascinating book. And Cohen isn't just sifting through old material. He managed to dig up some never-before-seen archival footage. It's from a documentary film that was being made in the White House on those pivotal days that he's writing about.
That's really interesting. The book is called 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke with its Canadian author, Andrew Cohen.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.